Hey, welcome to week two of the Letters to CSF podcast. My name is Dylan Matthews. I'm a staff member at Christian Student Fellowship at the University of Kentucky, and I'm here with my friend,
CJ. Hey.
Hey, and we are going to talk about the Bible with you. So last week we talked about Ephesians with Derek, and now we're talking about James this week. So we're doing some letters from Paul, some letters from the other apostles. Paul is, you know, the big hitter. He did a lot of the writing, but talking about James this week. So CJ, we're in James 1. But really quick, I want to say to you, the listener, before we jump in, if you haven't listened to read the passage for this week, go ahead and hit pause. Go read that passage. Spend some time in it yourself. Get some of your own ideas, what jumps out to you, and then come to this conversation. So if you haven't read, hit pause. Go read really quick. All right, and you're back? Great. Okay, awesome. Let's talk about it now. So CJ, we're in James 1. Tell me more about this work of writing as a whole before we jump into the specific chapter.
Gotcha. Yeah, this is written by James, and there's a little bit of discussion about who this guy James was. Some people have thought that this was the half-brother of Jesus. Some have thought that it's a different one of the James in the New Testament. It doesn't really matter for our purposes and for interpreting what we're going to read to know who wrote it, whether it was James's brother or Jesus' brother, or a different James. Especially, there's kind of disagreements depending on what tradition you're in about who this guy is. All of that to say, irrelevant, and I'm only telling you so that you don't get distracted by some annoying internecine debates about this guy. But really, the letter as a whole is a really interesting letter. A lot of people kind of categorize it as wisdom literature because it feels a lot more kind of Solomon-esque, Old Testament wisdom, and he talks about wisdom a lot. But this was a letter written by the leader of the early church in Jerusalem, James. And after the early church started exploding, and Stephen was the first martyr in Acts. You can go read about that in Acts 7. But the church splits. It spreads out. So everybody leaves Jerusalem, or a lot of Jews who have become Christians now leave Jerusalem because they're being killed for their faith. And so James is writing a letter to a bunch of Christians who have now gone out into other cities and are starting little church communities in these other cities. And he's heard some troubling things about what's going on in many of these cities. Because they were persecuted in Jerusalem, they're also being persecuted outside of Jerusalem because they're part of this new faith, which is seen in many ways as a threat to the established order. So he's writing to a bunch of people who are going through intense persecution. And because of that persecution, a lot of times are conforming their behaviors and their speech and their patterns of living more to the cultures that they're in, rather than staying faithful to the lifestyle and the message of Jesus. So he's writing a loving but also a very challenging letter to his followers who have now gone into other cities. And because he wrote it to all of them, this isn't just a letter that applies to like one church in Philippi. So he's not just talking about like really contextual issues, but he's talking about issues for the church as a whole. And even though all of the New Testament is applicable to us even today, this one is just really general advice, actually. So should be more easy for us to feel the application of this than maybe thinking about some of the really specific stuff that some of the other writers of the New Testament write to in specific cities. So we can relate because these people have converted to Christianity, and now they're living in cultures that are hostile to their faith, and they're tempted to take on the cultures of these cities rather than maintaining kind of the Christian identities that they had taken on when they became Christians in Jerusalem under James.
Wow, this is kind of blown my mind because I've read James before, but I've never quite grasped the first two lines or the first two verses, because when he says to those who are dispersed abroad, I've always just thought, oh, that probably just means like, you know, all the church, there's a lot of churches, so they're all, but actually he's speaking to specifically the like dispersion that happened after Stephen.
Yeah, these are probably people that were in the church that he was presiding over, who a lot of them have now left because they were being persecuted and killed, and you know, after Stephen was killed, they decided to get out of Dodge and try their hand in some other places. And even this is a fulfillment of what Christ said when he said that, you know, it's going to go to Jerusalem and then all Judea and then the ends of the earth. So we're seeing that kind of diaspora, that spreading out to the ends of the earth is happening here. And that initial wave was James's church.
Yeah. And then with that, he talks a lot about trials. And so that even puts into context what trials means when he's writing it. Because, you know, sometimes we don't want to just immediately assume, oh, James means my kind of trials. He means, you know, having to wake up when my alarm clock goes off or something, you know.
My mom's annoyed at me because I got a B.
Yeah, exactly.
he means real trials. Like these people have gone to these cities, they're being arrested and they're being imprisoned and they're being fed to lions and they're being killed. So I don't want to draw too much of an equivalence between like our trials and their trials. I mean, they were going through some intense stuff where to be a Christian was in many cities, just signing your own death warrant after you got baptized. But before that scares anyone off, like, well, what relevance does this have to me? Well, if he's writing his advice to people going through persecution so extreme, well, then it should be even doubly applicable to us who we do face trials and persecutions of certain kinds, not that extreme. But our trials, if he's giving that advice to them about their trials, it should be even easier for us to take his advice about our trials.
Yeah, that's helpful because I that was one of the questions I was going to ask you is, you know, how do we relate? And, you know, that just helps me understand, okay, so I'm still called to perseverance. And even if maybe my perseverance looks like just not being like a like emotionally flabby person who's like unable to deal with the small pieces of my life that kind of frustrate me, there's still a call to perseverance here that's really helpful to me because it's just like, I'm not getting thrown to lions or whatever the example would be. So I don't know how to deal with this, but that's really helpful.
Yeah. And I think the other kind of temptation is to think, this call is too hard. Like, my temptations, this guy has no idea what I'm going through. I'm going through some dark stuff, and you might be. A lot of people go through some really terrible, terrible stuff. But he's writing to a group of people who have also gone through some really, really, really terrible stuff, including, not yet, but later on, all of Christ's disciples traditionally were martyred for their faith, some of them in extremely brutal ways. And the only reason the Apostle John wasn't martyred is because traditionally they tried to do it and couldn't. This is some intense stuff he's writing about. So if it sounds too difficult to you, take heart because he's writing this to people for whom this would have been extremely difficult. And yet he's meaning to encourage them through this. But we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute.
Yeah, well, the encouragement thing is actually something I was surprised about too, because I've, you know, encountered James before and generally kind of gets this connotation of like, oh, he's the guy with all the commands in this single work of writing. He's got like more commands than most of the other letters in the New Testament. So I always just thought he was like, oh, this really dry letter that's just do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this. And I was kind of blown away that it has all this language or this essence of like encouragement that he says, my dear brothers, my dear friends, my beloved brethren, or these words in different translations that's being used. And I thought, man, I've always read James wrong, that James has seemed to me like he's this really dry, like, oh, you dummies, get it right. But instead, when I reread it this time, it was like, oh, wow, he's really seeking to encourage the believers that he's writing to. He's not trying to just put them down for not following these rules or not practicing wisdom or not persevering.
Yeah, James is a really great book. It was probably the first book in the New Testament that I read that I started taking very seriously and made me take my life very seriously. I was in a Bible study over this book, and I find his writing to be really beautiful. I think there is that kind of initial reaction of like, crap, this just sounds tough. Like, faith without works is dead. And I'm toast then, right? Kind of cold, detached, just like, you need to do all this stuff. But I think once you peel back the layers, it becomes much more beautiful because you do see this attitude of caring for his flock. And I also find him to just be a really rich writer as well. I mean, the passage we're reading today, verses 1 through 18 of the first chapter, are so filled with these beautiful images, these really imaginative images of the sea, the crown of life, that I think he is a really inspiring, and he's meant to be an inspiring writer. So he's inspired me, I think, even in this kind of latest reading, by having me imagine what he's trying to get me to imagine through these images, letting that really drive some of my desire for spiritual formation.
I love it. So then let's jump into some of the commands of this passage. And I think it's really unique and maybe a little surprising with kind of maybe the context that I came into this passage with of reading that the first command is to consider it all joy. He says the first thing is joy. Mm-hmm. That's the first command. So let's talk about that. What does he mean by joy in the sense that he's going to be talking about really enduring persecution, enduring trials, but he says, consider it joy. That's the command.
Yeah, I think there's so much to unpack here. I think first, it pushes against a notion that I've regularly had, even having been a Christian for a long time, that the life of a Christian feels kind of sad or like boring, or like you're told not to do all this stuff, like all the fun stuff you can't do. And so it seems like you have this just kind of boring or down life. And James is telling us that actually, no, that the very first thing is joy. The very first thing is joy here. That's what Christ came to give us. And that is what should mark our life. But even crazier than that is, again, when we get into the context here, these people are being killed. They're being fed to lions. They're being arrested. They're being jailed. Husbands and wives are being stripped from each other. Children are being taken from their parents. I mean, all sorts of crazy stuff. And yet James's command here, not just a suggestion, his command is to have joy. So what can it mean if he's talking to people who are watching their loved ones be murdered to have joy? And I think there's a really complicated discussion to have here, because I don't think what he means here is just like, laugh it off, everything's going to be fine. This kind of like naive optimism. It's like, oh, my brother got taken yesterday. It'll be fine. No big deal. I feel pretty happy about it. Like, that's just kind of, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah, like I don't even know if really would mean it would mean be happy about your circumstances.
Yeah, I don't think he means be happy. I think there is kind of an emotional element to it, but he's not just saying if you're unhappy, then you're doing something wrong. So there is a sense in which like the entire Bible is pretty adamant that like suffering is real, that death is real, that pain is real, and that all of these are really bad things, things that you should grieve over. I mean, Christ wept openly when Lazarus was dead. Even knowing he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead, he still wept over the death of Lazarus. The end of Revelation promises this, that promises us that there won't be any pain, there won't be any suffering. There's a real sense in which death, pain, suffering are the true enemies of God in the gospel. He's a God of life. So whatever James means here, it doesn't mean like you just kind of paper over the suffering and the pain and the death that's happening in our lives and just put on this kind of like fake smiley face and it's all going to be great. He can't mean that, because that would just run afoul of the rest of Scripture, run afoul of the promises that we get at the end of Revelation. So whatever he means here by joy has to be something deeper than this kind of fake emotional papering over of difficulty and pain and suffering. So what is it? I think it's the sense of security, maybe, that comes from knowing that whatever you're going through right now, however much, whatever suffering or however much pain you have right now, that is not like the last say, and that doesn't define you, and that won't define your soul, and that it's not a mark of kind of judgment, maybe. So that when he says you can have joy, well, you can be fed to lions and still have joy in the sense that you know that you are deeply loved by God, that you are obeying his will, and that very soon you will get to meet him face to face. And this sounds kind of all way too, it's too happy. It doesn't sound like it's realistic. And yet when we read, not even what the Christians wrote about themselves, but what like the Romans wrote about the martyrs, like as they were killing the martyrs, they were laughing, crying with tears of joy and singing hymns as they were actively being killed. And you're like, what the heck? How is that possible? I can't smile or sing a hymn when I'm having like a bad day because I got a bad test score. How are these guys doing that? And so I think, I don't know if explaining what joy is as good as reading or reflecting on, well, what is it about the saints that they had that as they were being killed, as their heads were being cut off, as they were being burned alive, and as they were being fed to animals, what did they have that let them sing? Because they weren't just like, oh, this pain is meaningless. This pain is fine. I love this pain. I think what they were, something about them must have had some deep, residing, abounding joy at the obedience that they had to God and the anticipation of seeing Christ and the anticipation of being welcomed home and hearing, well done, good and faithful servant. And so it might just be having more of like a heavenly perspective on what you're going through. So I know that's a long-winded answer, and it might not even be an answer for many people, like what is joy? But for me, when I think what is joy that he's talking about, it's not a definition that comes to mind. It's an image of the saint who's singing and praising God as he's being burned alive.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it creates such a depth to the word that means so much more than just like circumstantial happiness. Mm-hmm. But I think when I feel discouraged, discontent, whatever you think is the antithesis to joy, one of my initial thoughts is, oh, this is hopeless.
I think, yeah, if I had to pin down a single word that I think is the opposite here, it's not sadness. It's not boredom. It's despair. I think despair is the word that comes to mind here. That joy has something to do with hope, I think. Joy has something to do with the hope that allows you to reframe whatever circumstance you're in a way that doesn't let you despair when you see that match get lit. And it doesn't let you despair when you see that F on your term paper that you had to pass in order to get into the major that was going to define your life as you came into college. That despair would be the opposite, in my mind, to joy.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that, I think one of the things that's been the most helpful to me in moments where maybe I'm edging close to despair is just remembering the character of God, that the character of God is him who can use something like a cross for salvation, something that is an instrument of torture and death to actually flip it on its head and be the undoing of death.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's even what James is kind of getting at in this passage, that we can be joyful in our trials because it produces endurance, which leads to, or which grows our faith and makes it complete, is one of the things it says in the passage. And so for me, that's such an important thing, is to see kind of the result on the other side of the trial, because when I'm so despairing, all I can see is the trial. All I can see is the thing in front of me that's blocking my view from the way that God can take something that he's maybe not causing, but he can actually take it and go, no, we're going to make something beautiful out of it anyways.
Yeah. So I said earlier, I think one of the ways that I've come to appreciate James the most is by kind of engaging with the imaginative images he's trying to give. And for me, the word maturity here, is really powerful, because it invites me to imagine, what does it look like? Like, who is the kind of person that I'm wanting to be when I'm fully grown in Christ? And somehow the image of that person, the desire in my heart to want to be that person, is going to help me reframe the things I'm going through right now that are forging me into that person. I imagine, I've just started going to the gym again, Dylan. Yes, you can clap. You all can't hear the clapping. It's
I've never been.
But it's quite easy for me to get to the gym and have trouble lifting some rather light weights and feel like, you know what, this is not worth it. This is lame. It's never going to happen. I'm going to be a chewed up beef jerky strip for the rest of my life.
Ouch.
But I think that there's something powerful about having images of people who have gotten stronger, or those moments when I have felt stronger, or imagining in my mind, hey, what could it be like if I really kind of dedicated myself to being fit and healthy? And it's that image in my mind that lets me like do that one more rep. And again, not drawing a moral equivalence between lifting a lightweight in my case, and getting fed to lions. But I think the idea that James is telling us that trials, that things which are difficult and which cause us to want to despair. And again, the gym is just an example here. It's not even really relevant to this.
But you know, if you're the kind of person who struggles to go to the gym, i.e. me, I'm also probably going to struggle to like persevere through lion eating or something. So it's a small microcosm of the bigger issue. But yeah, sorry, interrupted.
No, so he's given this kind of imaginative picture. Imagine who you want yourself to look like in perfect obedience to Christ, to have the joy that Christ offers you by being perfectly obedient to him in the same way that he was obedient, even unto death. Because it's through that you come to look like him. He wants to make you mature. He wants to make you complete. He wants to make you perfect. And so I think perseverance here, it's just the word for when you look at your trials through the lens of who you are becoming if you are successful through those trials. He's wanting to make you like the bulky Christian, if we're back to the horrible gym metaphor here, right? Yeah. Where bulking up here is bulking up into the character of Christ. That trials can serve a purpose. God is not like sending you all of this horrible stuff God isn't causing you to go through these horrible things. I think it's really important that you pointed that out. And James anticipates that exact objection and says it a few verses later, like, God isn't the author of your temptations and your trials. No, no. What he can do is he can use them to grow you to be more like Christ. And I think it's when we're remembering, when we're imagining ourselves with that crown of life that he promises us a few verses later, if we persevere, standing next to Christ, maybe getting that standing ovation that, you know, Stephen got as he was being martyred, to let that help us reframe what we're going through so that we can face our current trials with a little bit more joy and a little bit more hope that what will come out of it won't be the end, but will be perfection.
That's good. Yeah, you mentioned perseverance, and I think that's a value that I wish it was more a part of my life. That I don't know, and maybe I'm projecting onto other people, and I don't want to do that, but I just think we are in kind of a whiny culture where it's just, you know, it's almost like a way to make a friend is to complain about something and then share in the complaint. You know, oh man, this, can you, like, we just started this new job together. Can you believe our boss? Oh my gosh, now we're friends. Rather than getting to know each other on some sort of like shared goodness, you get to know each other through complaint. Or even like the fact that in our culture, like outrage is a sign of like moral prowess.
Yeah.
That if you're just angry about an issue, that means, oh, you're a good person because you're angry about the right thing. Rather than doing the work of persevering through something and trying to set it right, seeking justice rather than just saying, oh, look, I can point out injustice, so I'm a good person. I think there's something to perseverance that is just lacking in our culture. And so James is calling us to that. So what's kind of the picture that he's painting for us? We kind of talked about it with joy, but what does perseverance look like for us on a college campus?
Yeah, I don't know that perseverance looks as much like, you know, I've got a really hard class and I need to just really like put my head down and my nose down and like study real hard. And that's what James means here by perseverance. You know, that's just being a good student. You probably should just do that anyway. I read this passage and think that he's talking more about persevering through the deep and heavy struggles of being a human being, not just the kind of mundane struggles of being a student. And I know for a lot of people, being a student doesn't feel like a mundane struggle because maybe your entire identity or your entire life is hanging on whether you get an A in Chem 105 so that you can become an engineer. I think that's probably a different problem if that's really where your identity is hanging right now. I'm imagining James talking about perseverance in matters of, I'm facing deep temptation right now. I'm tempted to doubt God in the way that he's talking about here, which is not just kind of like an intellectual doubt, like a question mark about God, but instead thinking of giving yourself to something else, thinking of giving yourself over to a different master, putting your loyalty in something else. I think it's kind of the dark nights of the soul that maybe he's talking about here. The things which are tempting us to take our ultimate loyalties away from God, and put them on something else, whether it's ourselves, whether it's money, which is what he's talking about a little bit later on, whether it's something other than God, which makes you kind of this, that's what he talks about, the double-minded, right? You're asking God for wisdom, but you're not really sure if you're buying into like trusting God. That's what I think he means by perseverance. Now, do you need to study for your tests and all of that? Yeah, but I don't want to confuse the Christian life with just doing like the normal stuff of like going to class. They're related, and you can be a good student, and that can actually help you become like more perseverant in your, is that a word? More, it can help you persevere more.
It is now.
More help you persevere better in kind of the deep struggles and temptations that you're going through. But I don't want to just make this about the mundane decisions that we have to do. We need to be faithful in the mundane decisions. You should just be a good student, not because James is telling you to persevere, but because you just need to be a good student. But when it comes to those times of trial and temptation, I think that's where James is really wanting us to listen to him and take encouragement from him. Because it wasn't just that these people had something difficult going on that James is writing. He's writing to a group who have trials and temptations that are so difficult that it's making them become like the world and cast off their faith. And I think it's those moments where we need to really lean in and do what he tells us to do here, which is to pray. Pray and ask God for wisdom and really believe that he's willing to give that to you and that whatever circumstance you're going through, he might not deliver you from the circumstance, but he's going to give you the resources you need to get through it. the wisdom, the perseverance, the hope, and that regardless of what's happening at the end, his will for you is to have that crown of life. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't want somebody to read James and just be like, oh yeah, he's talking about my tests. He's not. He would tell you to be a good student, I'm quite sure.
Yeah.
But he's talking about those times that maybe you're not as conscious of, but where soul-forming decisions are being made because of the temptations that you're going through. Those are the moments where you need to persevere. When your friends on campus are telling you to go out and do certain things, and you know that those are not the things you need to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I was thinking of when you were saying that, but it's like, you know, saying no to the drink at the party, saying no to the party maybe. I mean, yeah. Like, how many people have I, or friends of mine who have said, no, I actually am not going to drink tonight, or, oh, I really don't think I'm going to go out tonight. I don't think that's for me. People have responded to them and saying, why are you judging us?
Yeah.
You know, just feeling judged by someone's, like, exercising their own wisdom. Or I just think about, you know, the person who says, no, actually, I'm actually going to try to take the test, like, with my own notes and
not cheating,
or, you know, even to not just say no to stuff, but to say yes to stuff. Like, hey guys, I'm actually, you guys go find a seat at Synergy. I saw someone over in the corner who's sitting by themselves. I'm going to go introduce myself and just, I want to say yes to kind of the invitation of God to go meet someone new at Synergy instead of hanging out with the same group. Just saying no, saying yes, but persevering through those moments where, you know, it's like, it just feels difficult, or like we're called to step out of our comfort zone, or even probably there are deeper things that you would even reference beyond that. But those things came to my mind of just, they feel mundane, but they actually are deeply soul shaping for us.
Yeah. And I think he would definitely want us to make the right decisions there. And if we don't feel like we have the strength for it, to ask God for wisdom in it. So the last thing I want to hit here, just because we're running low on time here, is that temptation bit that you mentioned a little bit and I mentioned a little bit. Because I think a lot of people have this view of God that views him as kind of the tempter who's up there setting booby traps, waiting for us to fall apart so that our faith can be crushed and he can damn us to hell. And James is really, yeah, I think that's what a lot of people functionally believe. It's like, God, why are you tempting me like this? And James is like, it's not God, it's you, man. And I think he's extremely adamant here, because the picture he's wanting to paint is that God is actually for us. Like, he's on our side. He wants to give you that crown of life. When the trial comes, and it comes not because of him, but because of us, because of the temptations that we, kind of our own bad desires, want. When those come, not from him, but from us, he's on our side. He wants to give us wisdom, and he wants to crown us with life. But we're faced with this kind of divergent choice, whether we can take joy and persevere, recognizing that he's on our side, or whether we can start playing around with that temptation in our mind, conceive it, and then do it, which gives birth to death in our lives. And at the end of that road just is death. I think James is trying to tell us to not get confused, that God only wants one side of that road, right? When the temptation comes, which is not from him, he wants you to take joy through his help, through his wisdom, so he can crown you with life. And the other road has nothing to do with him. He does not want it. He doesn't want it for you. He's not going to help you go down it. He's not giving you the opportunities to go down it. He's wanting to give you the opportunities to go the other way. And I think a lot of times, unfortunately, the ways in which we think about God as tempting us, as trying to get us to stumble, as feeling angry with us and ready to damn us, I think actually that those ways that we describe God are the ways that James and the rest of the New Testament describes Satan as the one who comes and accuses and tempts, waits for us to fall, tells us lies, and then wants to condemn us. That's a perfect description of Satan. That's not God. So I wanted to throw that in there, because it's easy to think when we have trials, when we have temptations, and we need to persevere, that we're doing that despite God's help, despite God putting us in those situations. But it's actually exactly the opposite. We've put ourselves in those situations, or we're being tempted by Satan, and God's actually the one trying to, like, yank us out. He's the one who tries to bring us from that sea where we're getting blown about and anchor us in a safe harbor.
That's really good. That's good, important, practical theology. I think sometimes theology gets this word of only being in your head, but I mean, the lived reality of knowing God as that, as not the tempter, is a game changer. So that's great. That's really, really good. CJ, any last final thoughts from James 1 before we say goodbye?
No, I think he ends that verse, kind of 16, 17, 18, the best. And I'll just read what he says. Nice. Don't be deceived. every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like the shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. God's for us. He's the author of all good things, and he wants to invite us into that. So I think if we walk away with that in mind, it'll be a success.
That's a perfect way to wrap up. Thanks so much for checking out the Letters to CSF podcast. We hope it's been helpful to you. If you want to find more info or even our written curriculum for this Bible study, you can go to ukcsf.org/letters to CSF. Thanks for checking it out.